This is a shortened version of a course that I've been doing on the occasion of the bicentennial, basically. And it comes out of a book that a colleague and I wrote, a colleague from the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, called Defining America, A Christian Critique of the American Dream. And it's published by Fortress Press. And later, we've dealt with many lay and clergy groups over the last couple of years on this issue, and in the process we developed a little study guide that goes with the book for congregational use. And it was really aimed at the bicentennial discussion, centering on the question of what does it mean to be both a Christian and an American. And that's the perennial question of Christ and culture. A theologian by the name of Richard Niebuhr wrote a very classic book called Christ and Culture, where he laid out the different answers that have been given in Christian history, the different answers to this question of how do you relate one's Christian loyalty to one's national loyalty or to one's cultural identity. So this is this discussion of Defining America, A Christian Critique of the American Dream is a continuing part of that long perennial discussion of the relation of Christ to one's culture, nation, national identity. And it's particularly appropriate on this bicentennial occasion to think about that directly and seriously. There's been a lot of hoopla connected with the bicentennial, but perhaps the more we can gain some serious thought on the Christian's relation to American culture, the better off we can be. So that's basically what I'll be doing today and tomorrow, is pursuing this question of the Christian's relation to American identity. I'll really be handling about four blocks of material, just to give you an idea of what will be going on. One block of material deals with the question, what is American identity? Is there anything that makes us unique as a people? And we've made a stab at defining what we call the American dream or the American story, the American myth. Secondly, to look at what we call the dark side of the American dream. Our argument is that built into the dream itself is the potential for evil and suffering and pain. And the second block of material will look at the dark side of the dream. The third block of material deals with the meaning of the dark side. What's that saying to us from a religious point of view, our experiences of the dark side as Americans? And then finally, if we have time to get to this, and it's important that we do, what are the next steps? What ought to be the Christian stance in relation to the American future? What agenda do we have as a Christian people, as a Christian community in this country? And we propose that one part of that agenda is to do serious dialogue, serious conversation with the American dream, lifting up the divergences from our own Christian story, our own Christian identity, carrying on a dialogue or a conversation with this dream. So that's kind of the lay of the land of what we'll be dealing with. I'll tell you in advance that our answer to the question of whether one can be Christian and American at the same time is yes, one can. And that one's Christian identity gives one a transforming stance over against American culture. That is, an active stance of reflection and purposeful change in terms of the American dream and American society. But now that answer is not the only answer that's given to the question. And one of the benefits we've had is that our book was not intended as a bicentennial book. So it came out in 1974, one of the earliest books on the bicentennial discussion. The publisher, of course, thought of its usefulness as a bicentennial documents, so they put a few stars and stripes on it, and there we are. Yeah, right. So we've had the occasion to move around the country a lot with a lot of different kinds of groups, and it's very interesting the kinds of basic, sometimes visceral responses you get to this question of, can I be an American and a Christian at the same time? Because there's a large group, no, let's not put it that way, there's a very vocal, serious minority of people in this country who are Christians, who believe that really one can't be a Christian and an American at the same time. One has to resist the American identity at this point in history. Perhaps that's represented most sharply by a man called William Stringfellow, who many of you have heard of, who has written a book, An Ethic for Christians and Aliens in a Strange Land, or Other Strangers in an Alien Land. I always get the title turned around a little bit. But Stringfellow believes that America is the successor to Nazi Germany as the bearer of the symbol of the beast. That is, the American Empire is what Revelations, the book of Revelations, is talking about, that we are the beast and America is under the reign of death, and that the proper Christian response to America is resistance, and that one should, with all one's effort and life, find those places to resist the death that's inherent in America. And of course, they're a very serious group, a group that really demands our respect. People like the Berrigans and Stringfellow, and many, many young Christians who feel the same way. And most of them pay a lot for their convictions. That's not a very popular conviction, to say that our national identity is demonic and we as Christians must resist it in every way possible. So we run across those kind of people, and they are angered by our book, and as one of them put it pungently, you're just washing the blood off the flag and running it up once more and seeing how it goes. So there's that response to the question of one's Christian identity and one's national identity, that one can't be an American and a Christian at the same time. And on the other side of the scale, where people that we meet, but usually it's not articulated by important people, but it's the position that Richard Niebuhr called the Christ of culture position. That is, people who believe that to be a Christian means to be an American, to be an American means to be a Christian, that the two things just fit hand in glove, and that to criticize America is really criticizing Christ. And to criticize Christ is to criticize America. And they're the people who believe there's been such a fulfillment of Christianity in American life that one shouldn't really criticize either. And this kind of fusion of Christ and culture goes on in popular culture. In fact, in terms of danger, that group is so much larger than the first group I talked about, the Christ against culture people. Probably the major danger of any great nation is that the religious symbols are co-opted for national purposes. And so Christianity and Americanism is fused together like hand and glove. I think of some of the late night TV we see in Chicago with some of these religious programs on who kind of collapse Americanism and Christianity, and the way it goes is that America means winning, and Christianity produces winners, and therefore to be a Christian is to be a winner, and to be an American is a winner, and it's celebrated in many ways. Win with Christ, right? Perhaps the most vulgar representatives of that are Reverend Ike. If you're a Christian, you'll be rich, and to be rich is to fulfill the American dream. So there you get the collapse again. And you see that in celebrations of halftimes of football games. Sometimes you see it in certain kinds of Native American religion. that just collapses the two. And as I say, I think that's by far more dangerous than the Stringfellow types who try to clear your mind by saying you better think seriously about Christ's relation to American culture. Well, we try to operate in what could be called the classical Christian tradition, which would be in the middle somewhere, that there indeed is many gifts of the American tradition. There's evil in the American tradition, and the Christian imperative is, from its own perspective, to be able to affirm those values that are good and to make sure they are born into the future, to criticize those values and those parts of the American identity which are evil, and to stand in a reforming relation to American culture. Now, that sometimes doesn't make anybody happy, because those who believe that you have to reject America aren't happy with that, and those who fuse Christ and America together think you're being disloyal and unpatriotic. Well, I'm kind of telling you where we're standing at the beginning, and then we'll pursue, draw out the argument from there. The first task that we deal with in the book, and that I want to deal with here, is to try to define America. And that's an interesting task, because you ask the question, is there anything about us as a people that makes us different than other people? Is there some underlying story, underlying dream, underlying myth that we live out of as a people, and that's born by our culture, and that we're caught up in, and that gives us definition? And that's an interesting question. And you don't get at that by looking at politics, particularly. You don't get at that by looking at economics, how much we've produced here and there. But it's a cultural question. What is it that is the underlying story or myth that Americans live out of? Well, we made a stab at that, and I'll check out with you whether you think there's any accuracy to it at all. And I'll have to be a little shorthand about this because of time pressure, and I want to use the board here a little.
Push the board back and see if
that is that better?
Okay. Nice.
That's better. That's it.
Oh, too far. Right there?
Right there.
Okay. We pick up a rather common argument about the central vision of early America. And the central vision of early America was the Puritan vision of what was happening to them as a people and what they were about here on these shores. And Perry Miller and other people have written important books on the Puritan consciousness in terms of their own story about what they were doing on these shores. And they picked up the story of the Exodus as the way of defining who they were and where they were going. We use a little schema here of time frame, past, present, and future. And a story takes you along the past, the present, and the future. And the Puritans, it seems, from many historical interpretations, believed that they were living out the Exodus myth, the Exodus story. And for them, Europe took the place of Egypt. Europe was the symbol of the corruption and inertia of the past. Europe was a symbol of oppression and restraint. It was the bondage that the children of Israel experienced, and they saw themselves as the new Israel that was being freed from the bondage of Egypt, which was to them Europe, and being freed, elect, called on a journey away from that bondage. And one doesn't have to look far in the Puritan literature to find that motif running through it, the freedom from Europe. And of course, then the Atlantic Ocean becomes the Red Sea, and people cross it and engage in errand into the wilderness. In their exodus, they're engaging in an errand into the wilderness, just like the people of Israel did. So they're freed from bondage, cross the Red Sea, which becomes the Atlantic, to establish the new community in America, in the wilderness. The city set on a hill, the New Jerusalem, the Holy Community, And they believe they, humankind and human history had a new beginning in the wilderness, and they were shaping not only the new and pure church, but a new and pure political arrangement, a holy community. And what held that community together was a covenant, that ordered their life as they established and shaped the holy community in the wilderness. Now, if they freed themselves from the bondage of the past, of Europe, and participated as a covenant community in this wilderness, the promise would be theirs. And the promise, according to, again, the Old Testament vision, kind of a male chauvinistic age, was land and sons. That if they lived up to the covenant, they would be given the land flowing with milk and honey, the rich land. And they would be given sons who would perpetuate their names and their identities as they went out into the future. And as they participated in that story, gained the promise, lived up to the covenant, they would become a beacon to the nations. Other nations would emulate America and want to join in this story of freedom, of the new community, and of the promise. So many of the Old Testament motifs are there. The beacon to the nations, covenant and community, land and sons. And that, we believe, is the original, specifically biblical consciousness of the Puritan vision of what was going on in America. Now, there were other visions, but historians argue that this was the one that captured the center of American self-consciousness. So that, we believe, sets the shape of the drama, the shape of the story. Now, when we asked ourselves, I grew up in Nebraska, is that what came to me as an identifying myth or story? No. It comes clear sometimes in American life. Thanksgiving, we lift up many of those motifs. Many of these are here in the American self-consciousness. Yeah, it's still the idea that we're a beacon to the nation. The idea that we have a new beginning and we're not quite as corrupt as other nations. That in foreign policy, for instance, we act altruistically while other nations act out of self-interest. There's still vestiges of that, very specifically religious, the idea of a destiny. Specific vestiges of some of those very explicitly religious motifs that are in our story. But that isn't the kind of thing that I was brought up with as a kid that identified, that gave me a story, or that gave our people a story as we grew up in Nebraska and other places. Many of you grew up in the Midwest, and it doesn't matter where. There is, we believe, an American dream that is a secularized version of the original American myth. We call this the American myth simply because it picks up a mythic element in the Old Testament. And we move on to defining the dream, which we believe is a secularized version of the American myth. And many things happen to it as it comes down through history, but we believe the basic structure, the basic form of the drama is the same, and that gives us the story out of which we live our lives as Americans. And let me spell that out a little bit. We believe the dream goes this way, that our dream tells us that we can and ought to shake free from the limits of the past. That we can and ought to engage in a struggling ascent. I was going to say upward, but I guess that's redundant. To struggle upward. And that if we indeed do shake free from the limits of our past, we engage in a struggling ascent, a gracious and open future will meet us. We will be met by that. Now, you can see certain affinities with the original mythic element. It's a story, a linear story, where we're freed from something, moving upward towards something gracious and open, some promise. And this dream is born in all kinds of ways, by the overarching culture, but particularly by the public schools, by the secular liturgy of the year, 4th of July celebrations, a Memorial Day, by celebrations at the halftime of football games, by Thanksgiving, all different ways in which this dream is born to us, or carried to us, and communicated. And instead of biblical figures, American legends and legendary figures bear forward this dream. And one way I like to put it is the Abraham of Ur, the biblical Abraham, who was called to engage in the story. The Abraham of Ur becomes the Abraham of Illinois. Because the Abraham of Illinois is that mythic, legendary figure who was that poor boy splitting logs, coming from a poor family background, which isn't true, but that's the story. And the struggling ascended there, failures in business, political failures, all that. And finally, however, he makes it to the presidency at a time in which there's a national crisis. And before he can experience the reunion of the states, the promised land, the gracious open future, he dies like Moses before the promised land. He dies on Good Friday. And he dies on Good Friday, yes. And there's all kinds of interesting ways that American figures, and Lincoln is just one of them. Any of the early American heroes, the pioneers, flesh out that dream for us. The great boosters who built the early American cities, Kit Carson. We've got just a raft of particular figures that give flesh to that dream. I like to tell a kind of amusing story about how that transformation of the Abraham of Ur to the Abraham of Illinois takes place. In Sunday school, our daughter was in the class. They were asked to draw a picture of Abraham. They were studying Genesis, and she came home with the picture, and it was nicely done, a desert with tents and people with long flowing robes, and then the biggest dude among them with long flowing robes is standing there with a large stovepipe hat.
You sure you weren't raised in Illinois?
Well, you know, it's just uncanny how these images come to us. In Illinois, of course, Lincoln's birthday is a big thing. The schools are out and all that. This past February, our kids were out of school, and the teachers prepare the kids the days before for the holiday. And I was talking with my 7-year-old son at his bedtime, and I said, you know why you're out tomorrow? Oh yeah, it's Abraham Lincoln's birthday. I said, well, you know anything about Abraham Lincoln? He says, oh yeah, I know a lot about Abraham Lincoln. Well, tell me a little. And he says, well, Lincoln was a poor boy, and he split rails, and was very honest. He didn't tell any lies or take any money, and he worked real hard at getting an education. In fact, he at night in the log cabin, he would sit by the fire, which was flickering like that, and the light of the fire would scratch his lessons on the back of a shovel with a charcoal stick. And I thought, wow, that's exactly the images, you know, that are very, very early in my life and in my education. Probably everybody in the room would have those same kind of images. Well, that's the way the dream comes to us. And let me flesh this out a little bit. It means that we expect as Americans to move up from where our parents were. And that means geographical and social. That is, we expect to better the station of our parents, to do better. And that almost always means geographical mobility, moving from one place to the next. But it means the expectation that we'll do better, and that the restraints of the past are not applicable to the American. The American moves on and leaves the past behind in his search, in his struggling ascent. So this has meant a flexibility with regard to tradition and precedent. We're a people very flexible in relation to the past, and we give up our roots and we move on. Sometimes we carry our roots with us, but we're a moving people. West Coast people know that perhaps better than Middle Western people. And part of that is to do better, to move up. And so the value that that brings with us is that value of liberty or freedom from external restraint. We move where we want to move. We associate with whom we want to associate. And in our national documents, this freedom from external restraint is there. And European civilizations, other kinds of socioeconomic systems can control the movement of population. Americans don't control the movement of population. This is an example. So that sense of freedom from external restraint, that expectation that we'll do better than our parents. And the struggling ascent has all kinds of elements of the national character in it. We admire the self-initiation, the self-starter, those who are self-reliant, that can move out of their own initiative, out of their own spontaneity, can shape their lives and engage in that struggling ascent. That has a notion of discipline to it. One disciplines one's desire for present pleasure for the sake of the future. One sacrifices that present pleasure for the sake of the future. We admire generalized intelligence. And Daniel Boorstin has a four-part history of the Americans. And one of the things he says is so clear about the American character coming from the frontier experience is that specialized knowledge and abilities were not at such a high premium, because when you got out into an area like this, you had to be able to do a lot of things. And so generalized practical intelligence is a high premium and part of the American character. And one of the social characteristics, if you self-initiative, independence, self-reliance, one of the social characteristics of American life is a high degree of voluntarism. That is, as part of that struggling ascent or getting things done that people want done, citizens band together and voluntary associations and do for themselves what the state or someone else has done for many peoples. That is, there's an astounding variety and number of voluntary associations in American life. And that's one of the characteristics of the American dream. People get together and shape things privately out of their own initiative. Holden Village is a fantastic example of a voluntary association that plays a specific role and function. No one is suggested from above. The state has not had much to do with it. The voluntary church is there. We could talk about hundreds of examples of that voluntarist spirit in American life. So this lifts up the value of initiative, corporate and individual initiative. It's interesting to trace the immigrant groups as they came and participated in the dream. They shook free, they engaged in the struggling ascent, and from the beginning, it's kind of a corporate struggling ascent. The Swedes stuck together, the Norwegians stuck together, now the blacks stick together, the Latinos stick together to some extent. There's still a little sense of covenant in those early experiences. But as people gain that open, gracious, and future and begin to ascend, then it becomes the dream of individual ascent. The corporate idea is lost. We struggle upward as individuals, not as groups any longer. But the value of initiative, sometimes corporate initiative, but mostly individual ascent initiative. Well, if we shake free from that path, engage in the struggling ascent, the American character has been shaped by an optimism about the future. That is, a door will open. Our efforts will be rewarded by a benevolent future that will grasp us. And that doors do, in fact, open. Now, Boorstin says, when in the history of mankind did a people ever put so much trust in the unexpected? Over the next hill, it'll be better. Next year, it'll be better. And Washington will be better than Iowa. in California will be better than Nebraska. And not knowing exactly what's around the hill, but over the hill, but what? Optimism about it. And if it's not geographical optimism, it's this optimism about the social space, that there's always something there for an enterprising person. The doors will open, and the future will be gracious to us. Well, that, I think, is the fundamental of a story. The dream that comes to us is a story. And if you notice, there's no content to it. It doesn't say what you ought to be doing. What it is that you shake free from and struggle toward. It doesn't say that. And that's part of the American genius also, of diversity and pluralism. And many people came to this country for various reasons, and we engage in struggling, in a sense, with all different kinds of content put to the dream. Some of you are perhaps Missouri Synod. The religious dream, kind of a repristination of the Puritan ideal, much later in American life, where they shook free from what they considered to be oppression in Germany. And as a group of people began the struggle in ascent, and America has been sweet and good to them, and now they're foundering on a new kind of oppression from within themselves. Others came for sudden riches. You know, they came as adventurers and thought they'd strike it big. Others came because they were so blasted poor. The Swedes out of famine, the Irish out of famine, the German peasants with no hopes or very little hopes in Europe came just to make a living and to gain those land and sons that they had hoped for. Others came for political liberty and the political ascent. A tremendous variety of content put to that dream. I guess the kind of content that was given to me by my family was not riches or a rising standard of living, but it was to do well. Whatever you choose, do it well. And that was hammered home in many different ways. And it didn't so much matter where you ended up, but to do it well was kind of the content put to that dream. Take the Jewish tradition in America. Wow. Commitment to excellence and discipline and how that is driven home. So the dream is open, filled with many different kinds of content. One of the suspicions today is that we've lost the variety and pluralism of the dream. But it's open and formal. Now, one of the, I think, interesting and important parts of our argument is that we're dealing here with a very powerful cultural story that functions as a religion for a people. It has a religious function. And that all of us, in various degrees, participate in that religious element in American life. Every nation has a story that functions religiously for them. And here's how I would make that argument with a religious function. This story, the dream, functions as a religion in several ways. The first one is that it organizes our experience and gives a structure of meaning to it. It answers the question, what's happening to me? And I must say that my own life has been very much part, can be interpreted and given structure and meaning by that dream. It's just very clear. My parents both anchored in Nebraska, had not moved, not educated. No one in our relation had gone off to college. And so, you know, springing free from that small town, going to college was a shaking free from the limits of the past. A struggling ascent, college, graduate school, working hard, and making that ascent. And then every time a crucial moment would come, a door would open. It was natural to go to college if you got a scholarship. It was natural to go to graduate school, go to Germany to study if an opportunity was there. And the opportunity was there, finish graduate school, and a job offer comes to teach in a seminary. And the door opens. Without even knocking, it opens. You know, and it's been a beautiful experience. That dream is part of my life very, very much. And I would be a fool and dishonest if I wouldn't recognize that, and in some measure be grateful for it and celebrate that dream. So it gives structure, meaning, shape to one's own life. But that's not all it does. That structure and meaning that is given relates one to a larger whole. A larger reality. And let's begin from my life and work outward. It relates me, first of all, to the generation that went before me, my specific family. My parents were Depression people, came from more difficult parts of Nebraska, and they couldn't make it on the farm, so they came to the small town. That was their trek from the limits of their past. They came from the farm to the small town, and they couldn't get a college education. There was no money. But they worked, struggled, brought up three kids, didn't have much money at all. Finally, the three kids got out of their lives, all went to college, and they got an inheritance from Grandma and Grandpa, bought a Dairy Queen, and are doing beautifully.
The curtain comes down.
Not only making a lot of money, but kind of being free from the necessity to eke out a living. My dad got politically involved, ran for city council, made that, and then even got more civic-minded than that, decided to run for mayor, and the kids said, "Oh, no, don't do that. He'll embarrass the whole family. You can't put a sentence together, you know. Oh, anyone." And that relates me to my parents. And then my grandparents are both immigrants, coming from Germany. And they really participated in a very literal way in that dream. But that isn't all that relates to me, to my family, but that then that family points to all of us, and particularly around here, all of us who have made that ascent and whose families made the ascent. That great moving stream of Americans who came to this country and found liberty, found opportunity, engaged in the struggle and ascent. Millions and millions of people symbolized by the Statue of Liberty and all that. And that's a powerful, powerful relation to that whole movement, and most of us do feel those heartstrings twanged a little bit when Old Glory goes up at times, and that's what it's referring us to, the broad stream. Well, it's not only that, though. That's not the end, that whole stream of Americans moving in the dream, but that dream itself points back to values that are not just arbitrarily chosen by America, but which we believe are values that are universal values. So that the value of liberty, initiative, and over here opportunity, natural opportunity, ought to be values for everybody. But finally, the values that the American dream bears forward are anchored in the structure of reality itself, in God's will. And God's will is that we should be free to be able to have initiative and express our free creativity, and that we should have opportunity in the future. And you see, the point I'm making is that the dream pushes back and back and back to a universal frame of meaning and reference. The values are projected onto a universal screen, and the dream bears that commitment to those values which we believe are universal and that all people ought to be able to share. So it's a very interesting way that the dream plays a religious function. And finally, the third function of the dream as a religion is that it lays an ethical imperative on people. That is, it becomes a model for their lives. And people feel that they should model their lives according to the dream. And I think it's not hard to find evidence of that. If your kids have been to school, how the dream comes across, those expectations to better the station of their parents, to engage in the struggle in the sense, to hope for an optimism about the future, is part of the ethical imperative that comes with the dream. Well, I think that structure, that dream, is very deep in all of us. And you have to understand that if you're going to understand America. And I believe that political figures, the shrewdest of them know that. They know that 75-80% of the American people feel that's a true dream, that's a true story, that's been true for their lives. And one of the clues, I think, to why McGovern got clobbered so badly, and here McGovern had tried to lift up very specific religious elements in the dream, come back America, you know. McGovern got identified either, let's not go into how he got identified, but got identified with elements in American society that spit upon the dream, that rejected the dream, and they... And American people saw that much more so than any programmatic suggestion that McGovern made. McGovern went down the tube because he was identified with people who rejected and hated the dream. Now, Nixon, on the other hand, knew how to play the American dream. In fact, isn't he an archetypal American hero himself? Poor parents. His last talk on the White House lawn as the helicopter came to get him, how he talked about his sainted mother who had sacrificed for him, his father died, the low beginning, the six crises struggling upward. Finally he makes it, after sure defeat in the California senatorial election, he makes it. So now, that's a little of a political excursion, but I believe that a great number of the American people believe this to be a true dream, and it has been true to their lives, given order and meaning to their lives and related them to a larger whole, and that's a very strong reality that has to be recognized as we as Christians live with one foot in the American dream and in the religious element of American life and one foot in the Christian community. Now I think we're probably to the end of the time on this segment, and I'm way behind, but that's all right. I'll be here. Some of you want to go to coffee, so you're free to go. But if any of you want to stay and talk, I'll be glad to talk a little bit about this dream.
Did you say tomorrow you were going to talk about the dark side?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because there is a dark side. Yeah, because they don't show the self-initiative, yeah. The discipline.
I remember I had one funny story. I was buying stamps up in Alexandria, Minnesota, and I had forgotten the stamps had gone from 8 cents to 10 cents. And I was standing in line, and I said, nobody in particular, what price is just keep going up, don't they? And some middle-aged person said to me, yeah, it's all these damn people on welfare. That was, I just wasn't ready for that.
You were talking about postal stamps, not food stamps.
That's terribly important.
Oh, sure. This sets the way we look at others. If we're,
if they really wanted to, they could get a job. No,
that's right. And if you believe the opportunities are still there naturally, then it is the fault of the other person
right.
That the job.
I have to think too that. For many of us, like you mentioned, we aren't very many generations removed from the old country. So it's right in our own immediate family.
Oh, it is. Oh, it's very powerful. And then you ask questions about how the next generation will relate to that, particularly people who have made a rather sharp ascent into the professional classes. What do the kids do? What's the next stage? How are the kids going to ascend from there? And the powerful expectations of many parents if they ought to. Wow.
So one of the things that you mentioned, food stamps and welfare people, phenomena which I'll be interested to see if I can tie in or if you do is when college kids are coming from affluent families are on food stamps to get to college money, which is a strange twist, or it's rebellion, or I don't know what, but.
Well, I get some visceral feelings about that. I'm not sure that children of affluent parents should be cashing in on food stamps. That's a very deep
relationship to this initiative. That maybe
that's right.
You're striking towards toughness to the bad side of things.
And at the same time, say a woman with a child is alone, mm-hmm. and looking and trying to make it. But because she's a woman, because she doesn't have enough education, she's not making them and needs food stamps mm-hmm. and needs a little assistance. The welfare department don't want to give it because she's working. She would stay home and take care of her child and take everything she could have in mm-hmm. her money.
Well, we've got some very strange laws.
Yeah.
Our laws don't give incentive to people. You know, if they make so much, then they lose the benefits. Yeah. What do you think this is fairly accurate about the American character?
You said 75% to 80%.
That's a rough guess, but I was heartened to see.
I was heartened. The Gallup poll did something about 2 months ago on American expectations, and it was astounding. 80% of the people felt that they were better off than their parents. 75%, and even in spite of all of what we've gone through, 75% thought that the future was going to be better than the present. And I take that to mean that the dream's not dead. And there was a lot of premature obituaries about the American dream, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And,
at the same time that people thought that God was dead.
America's dead, too, yeah. Yeah.
I think many of the students who are on food stamps and are from affluent families also believe very strongly in this American dream. But what they want, they're rejecting the fact that they're placed on such a high level, and they want to achieve a higher level than their parents on their own, with their own energy, with their own independence in mind, mm-hmm. And yet they're denying somebody who is really needy mm-hmm. by that, but I don't think they have necessarily rejected this American dream.
Oh, no, I don't
want to start at the level where their parents
right.
are.
They want to see if they can
at
do
age 50
it.
Or 60. Yeah, yeah. They want to start from there and get better. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on their own if they're taking food stamps. That's taking yeah. from the corporate parents.
Right, yeah,
family.
But they just...
Well, there may be a kind of compensatory device to make yourself feel poorer and lower than you really are, so that the ascent becomes...
greater.
You tell your own kids that. I was on food stamps when I was
in
college.
It was rough.
It was rough.
The rattiest houses to live in.
Yeah.
And the worst apartments and things like that. Just to tell you. But
then look at their stereo or something.
Yeah, that's
the dream,
right.
Though, I think of the parents, us,
yeah.
our I-5 kids,
yeah.
is so deeply ingrained in what you're saying. I think that we push, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I think we all are looking at how do we give our kids some freedom from our dream,
mm-hmm.
which has been pushed from all the millions of people, you know, and now is weighing so heavy on us as parents.
And sometimes
what would our kids do?
And sometimes it's a change in content.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the struggling ascent of the parents has been for making money, making it comfortable. But
mm-hmm.
they've felt empty about that, something lacking, and so they try to take the next generation, give them a different content
yeah.
of the struggling. The Kennedys are an archetypal example of that. Joe Kennedy makes all the money, but then all the kids are inculcated with values of political responsibility, so they all... you couldn't go much further economically than Joe Kennedy. You have to find some other channel.
So that lack of content is, I think, very critical thing, and because it does change, and it's hard to be able to
yeah.
to accept another content level when
yeah.
you're less successful or whatever.
Yeah, and then, you know, the overriding question that people like Al Pitcher raised so strongly is whether the content has not really become homogenized. And in many ways, we're hooked into the idea of the consumer's dream and the American dream that excellence has gone by the boards, cooperation, many other kinds of content are gone, social responsibility is gone. What you have is people being hooked into a vast machine aimed at consumer delights. The living, rising standard of living has become the American dream. And I'm not ready to buy that in any overriding way.
Consumer, you're not ready to buy
it. No, I was afraid you'd catch that. Yeah. Yes. But I believe there's still a lot of diversity there and a lot of dynamic, but I agree that the temptations and the tremendous persuasiveness and heaviness of the media on consumption is a terrific threat, I believe, to the dream. The dream as it's come to us in a healthy form.
You began by talking about the bicentennial. I don't remember if it was Time magazine or where, but I read that some editorial signaling that we were all surprised. The government was surprised, and all of the American citizens were surprised that really, what a great time we had celebrating our 200th birthday. You know, how it really was a joyful, heartwarming occasion, and much more spontaneity to it than we had ever expected.
Much more authentic. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the TV coverage of it was just fantastic. It was Walter Cronkite. What is that? NBC, CBS, all day long. It was really, really was engaging to watch that. We went to fireworks down at Navy Pier in Chicago, and they estimated 700,000 people showed up just for fireworks. You know, the fireworks were not all that great, but it was a nice night. 700,000 people show up, shut off the outer drive, which is the main artery of traffic. And people were sitting on blankets on the outer drive, and the traffic was stopped dead. And people got out of their cars, and instead of people being angry and irked and impatient, everybody just joined the celebration. Everybody was so polite, so friendly, and then where the fireworks go, everybody sees fireworks, and there's nothing particularly unusual about them. But when a good one would go off, everybody would go, ah! It was the kind of a naivete and childish or childlikeness about the celebration. It was really kind of captivating, I thought.
Had a great big fireworks celebration in the end for the Washington, you know, right across Portland and across the river, and we didn't make an attempt to go, for which I was glad, because friends of ours that attempted to go couldn't even get there. The traffic was so great, and some of those who got there didn't get out
for hours and hours. But the only way you can account for that, it seems to me, is that there is a powerful religious function being played by national identity that draws people to that, and you can participate in it with real vitality. Yeah.
It was I don't know. I'm from Minnesota, but we had in our papers publicity that even the weather cooperated. There was in the United States, there was only one place where it rained.
On the Washington. A cheap shot.
One of the things that comes to me as we're talking right now about the bicentennial, we've been a New Testament country in a sense more recently, and I think what happened this year is we began to read the quote Old Testament, because we don't know our history besides myth that we learned in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade as adults. So I think part of the authenticity was actually going back and reading the Old Testament of the dream and finding that, hey, you know, there was some very specificness about it that you lose as you get caught up in the ascent.
That's right.
And the promise.
Secularization.
So we become almost a New Testament country.
Yeah. Watching where we are going rather than from whence we came.
That's right.
Many European countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But one thing that keeps running through my mind in here is, I've been very persuasive in the story and so on. I see it in me, if I can see it in you. The one thing that bothers me is the middle part there, the struggling toward the sense, is that I sense, maybe just my own, becoming aware of other people, more and more of, instead of self-initiative and self-working, it's like they see on television, they're interviewing some area that's been had a strike going on for months, or great unemployment or something. They're interviewing some guy, how bad it is that he's been unemployed, and he just can't find a job, he's been looking for 13 months now. The government ought to do something about it. Mm-hmm. There ought to be a law against that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe what are the other people, what are the rest of you's reaction to this? That are we losing our feeling of that individual struggle towards this a sense and saying, looking toward that something better and saying they,
But I think the problem with self-initiation, what I'm getting to, is that what's the content of it? I mean, what are you struggling into? Is it, when you look at somebody struggling in, isn't that wonderful? He's great. He's just struggling. Well, he might be climbing over 20,000 other people to get to the top. And isn't that wonderful? Well, I have problems with that. And what that individual, and I know you probably talk about the dark side of that thing tomorrow in terms of, you know, just to be an individualist and just to struggle has been problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of what you say is perhaps the, not the destruction, but the erosion of this idea of natural opportunity in the
and
future.
The self-initiative and volunteerism versus expecting
the doors to be open. What I'm saying, the original dream is that the doors will be open. They're there. They're opening. And it's very hard for Americans to understand that the doors may be closed.
Yeah.
And any sense of intentional opening of the doors by the society is hard for us to understand. I've got a long-standing argument with my parents that they really cannot understand that unemployment may be caused by an interdependent economic system and not by the fault of the person unemployed. That's really hard for them because they believe that if someone wanted a job, they could
get one.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that stopped me cold when you were talking about this, and it's sort of a sense that you were just were sharing, when you mentioned something about the ethnic groups coming over, the Irish and the Swedish, and how that sense of community, which was very supportive, you know, and I think maybe characteristic more of Europe, and then the image used of the first child breaking out of that on his own, you know, it just stopped me cold, because we lost an awful lot at this point.
Sure did.
Even as I think we do now with the whole sense of the individual yet being so primary. Mm-hmm. And yet not using the sense of community.
Yeah. And
I think we personally lost that. My husband moving from Minnesota to Medford, Oregon.
Yeah.
And didn't know a soul. And discovering that Lutheranism was, you know,
a minority.
And all around us on a Sunday was a time when everybody did all their gardening. almost like a whole different culture.
Culture
somebody
shock.
Had given me the money to go back to Minnesota the first year we were there, I would have gone. I would have said, heck with it.
No, I think that's part of the dark side.
Yet it was a shock for me, having, you know, my folks were the generation who moved out here from the Midwest, and I grew up out here in Washington. It was a shock to me when I first became aware of, you know, that culture you're talking about being back in Minnesota. In fact, it happened to me when I was up here the first time, 10 years ago. Man, you know, I came out here and all these people who are staff people got to visiting one with another and whatnot, and, you know, you went to Luther and you went to Concordia, you know, and I... My older sister was your cousin's roommate.
Yeah, right.
It was very difficult to comprehend.
Yeah.
Everybody was in the same Lutheran group. They all had the same three or four different church colleges and just family tradition, you know.
Well, and my husband and I could still identify with the small towns in which we grew up. And my husband still enjoys getting a hometown paper and reading it after all these years and so on. But our son now moving from Medford to Beaverton, Oregon, doesn't have that. I mean, sure, he's got a few friends to visit Medford and maybe a few friends in Beaverton, but when he's got, you know, but that's it. Yeah. And now, of course, our son has worked at Holden Village and stuff. I think maybe Holden Village might be hometown. Though.
Well, there's a real search then for roots, I think, if you don't have any. I have a very strong sense of roots from Nebraska, but I'm not sure my kids have any sense of roots in relation to Chicago or anywhere else. My one, that's part of the dark side.
That's what I'm saying about the roots for our children when we move like that.
There's a presumption.
Well, there's a desire that parents have for their children to better themselves and to, you know, to make it, because that makes them look successful. You know, the same way son's a doctor and he's working. They still want to be close to home. I had been living like a 2-hour drive away from home, and yet when I moved to where I was a 1/2-hour drive from home, oh, isn't that wonderful? And here I was, my parents and church, Isn't it wonderful that Judy's close to home again? You know, they didn't see any more of me than they had before. In fact, I was so busy they saw less of me. But isn't it wonderful she's close? And isn't it wonderful your grandchildren are close and you can see them every week? And they're really big on that, you know. And last year, my mother almost hit her head in shame because I had resigned from my teaching job and I was unemployed. And for 6 months, when people asked her what Judy was doing, she had to say, I don't know. And that is the end of the world.
She has a purpose, she has not gone astray.
It's just so funny because it's that obvious and it's just so funny when kids are
building on their little farm in a town, you know, near a town of 180
people, that's the biggest thing in the world. It's funny how they want to push us out of the nest, but they want to keep us in.
Yeah. You were going to say something.
There's a presumption that unless our kids have the same kind of roots that we have, that they're just not going to make it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, the same experiences we had, that's a terrific temptation of parents. If they don't have the same experiences we had, they're losing something. And indeed, they have a different set that may be just as rich as ours.
The type of people that gather here have come to think of this more of the small town type of thing, but the ghetto doesn't have a rich heritage of the people that came there from the state. Don't have wherewithal in that context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's an exception to the American dream being the black experience in America? That we say that the American dream applies to white America, but to black America it doesn't, because we don't want them to struggle into white society.
That's a very good question, and that belongs a little bit to the dark side of the dream we'll talk about tomorrow, but. You know, Martin Marty wrote a fascinating book called The Righteous Empire, and his laying out of the story is not so different than ours.